So, everybody ready? Not sure whether I am. I've set myself a rather difficult task today. Anyway, I need to start by recapitulating very briefly, just to remind you of where we've got to. We're looking at the laws that govern human happiness and fulfillment. Of course, we operate in a world that's governed by laws, according to the Buddhist perspective. We live in a world that in which things arise in dependence on conditions. And there are certain laws that govern the way in which our own minds arise and re-arise, and the way in which our minds find the highest and ultimate fulfillment. So it's these that we're examining. We've been especially examining for the last 2 days the law of karma, which is not just a single law, really. It's a law that encompasses a range of processes that operate within us and from us. And today we're going to move on to look at the dharma niyama, the dharma laws, the laws of the dharma that operate within us potentially, and that can take us to enlightenment itself. The laws of the dharma, you could say, are those laws which govern the arising of Buddhas, arising of enlightenment. So just say a little bit about karma, and then we'll move on to the topic of dharma. Karma is the law that states the relationship between an experienced self, a self as an agent, and the influence coming back from around us and inside us. It's especially the law that governs the way in which our own volitions of body, speech and mind, form the way in which our own consciousness, our own awareness, our own mental states arise in the future. So that the law of karma determines the way in which we recreate ourselves, for better or worse. What we are now, what you experienced in the meditation practice just now, is to some extent, perhaps quite a large extent, formed by the way in which you've used your mind in the past, the kind of thoughts you've had, the kind of wishes you've had, what you've said, what you've done. All of that finds its expression in the images that come into your mind, the general tone of your mind, the quality of your awareness. All of that is shaped to a substantial degree, not totally, but substantially, by your own volitional activities, your own intentions, your own wishes, your own desires, and the way in which those manifest themselves in speech and action. So we're recreating ourselves all the time, and our Buddhist practice initially is taking possession of that possibility. We take possession of ourselves as karmic agents. We take responsibility for creating ourselves in this sense. We haven't, of course, got infinite responsibility. We can't be whatever we want to be, but we can shape our own future arising experience. We can shape the quality of it, the fineness of it, even the delicacy of it. We can shape the beauty that we're capable of experiencing, or our capacity to experience beauty, our capacity to experience truth. All of that we're shaping through our Buddhist practice. When we're doing meditation, when we're practicing ethics, when we're putting ourselves into favorable environments and engaging in real communication, we're reshaping ourselves in the future. This is the law of karma, and it's really we need to engage in to a very great extent to begin with in our spiritual lives, in our Dhamma lives. When you come to a center like this, your learning techniques, which will help you to work more effectively with these underlying laws that in reality they're not something constructed. They're part of the way things are. They're part of the nature of things, just as the law of gravity is. So these take us a very long way. The acting in accordance with the laws of karma can bring for us a much more satisfying experience. They can make us feel much more in tune with the world around us. They can give us a great deal of a great deal more fulfillment, a greater sense that we're doing what we need to do, particularly a greater sense of harmony with other people, even the natural world, even with the world in the sense of everything, the world in the sense of everything. There you are. They can bring us into a greater sense of harmony with our experience. But that karmic development leaves a sort of problem, because it's based upon the idea of self as a separate agent, self as separate from experience. We carry within us a strong certitude of our own independent, abiding existence. And whilst that is the initial basis for our karmic evolution, it leaves a problem. It leaves a sense of disquiet, a sense of unease. Maybe you immediately know what I'm talking about, maybe you don't. I remember when my mother was very, very old, and she was bedridden for 8 years. She had a stroke and was bedridden for 8 years. And towards the end of her life, I remember going to visit her. The first thing she said to me when I saw her was, "I'm fed up with being me." And, it was very, very touching, very poignant. I knew what she meant. That sense of being separate, of always having to make an effort, of always being having to be responsive, and above all, that sense of slight or quite strong difference, of alienation. This is what karma cannot ultimately deal with. Karma leaves us still with this sense of ourselves as something separate, as something for which we must take conscious responsibility. Yes, it can become very, very refined, very, very subtle, so that we feel we're almost part of everything. You know, those wonderful moments when the barriers really do seem to go down, and you really do seem to feel that you're flowing with everything in your experience. Maybe moments of aesthetic appreciation in a concert, or listening to music, or just in the beauty of nature, seeing a beautiful sunset or something like that, or in deep communication when you really feel you're almost merging with the world around you. But it goes, it fades, it sort of dissolves, and you're back into the sense of separation, of isolation, with a sort of sense of struggle. The need to renew your effort. According to the Buddhist perspective, as long as you only rely on karma, this will be your experience. You can build yourself up. You can create for yourself a very fine, refined experience, which is almost dissolved into everything, where the struggle is almost over. There's just that little sense of disquiet, that little sense of disturbance. There's a famous incident in, or sort of theme, in Goethe's Faust, where Faust, as you know, we know, makes a pact with the devil, and he's very clever. He makes it up in Goethe's Faust, unlike Marlowe's Faust. His pact with the devil is that he will be the devil's as long as he can experience a moment that is entirely satisfying. That's his pact with the devil. And for all Mephistopheles' arts, he cannot provide that. The world cannot finally make perfection. There's always, if nothing else, just the residual sense, this is going to pass. This is going to fade. This cannot last. You can sort of dull that sense. You can live in a sort of opiate dream. But at the back of it all, there's a sense that it's going to fade, it's going to pass. Your most glorious moment will pass. And if you're at all sensitive, you'll know that. Even in the midst of your greatest joys, there's a sense that this is not abiding. So mere karmic development that's based entirely on will, it's entirely on volition, can get one very far indeed, and it's extremely important that we engage in it for reasons that I hope will become clear, but it cannot resolve the deepest problems of life. And what we need to do is open up to processes that, again, are implicit in reality, that are part of the nature of things, give ourselves up to them, and live on their basis, rather than on the basis of this egoistic volition. So the Buddha taught, Buddhist tradition has taught in many different ways, that there are, yes, processes that will open up once we see through the illusion of our abiding separateness, our abiding permanent, isolated selfhood. Once we see through that, processes begin to unfold quite naturally. A sequence of conditions unfold which take us to ultimate fulfillment, which take us ultimately to Buddhahood. These are part of the nature of things. They're not constructed. They're not something that we decide to have. They're experienced more as something that we give ourselves up to. In a way, they're not separate. They're not, gods or forces outside us. In a way, they're not even forces inside us. They're processes that are implicit in reality. Just as gravity is implicit in the way reality is constructed, so that as soon as certain conditions arise, heavy bodies and light bodies come together. And when you jump, you fall to the ground. It's just implicit in the way things are, for reasons that, in a sense, we can never entirely fathom, because the questions we have to ask involve us sort of getting outside reality and looking into it, which, of course, we can never do. In Kant's terms, they're questions that are ultimately too big for our minds. So these laws that govern the arising of Buddhas, the arising of liberated beings, are part of the nature of things. And we have no power to construct those laws. We can't cancel them either. Once the conditions arise, those processes start to unfold. And the conditions that they arise in dependence upon are primarily our seeing through the illusion of separate selfhood. It's a very large topic, which I'm not going to make the central theme of this evening, and maybe this sort of leaves you with a central question. If that's the case, please ponder it. And if you get the answer, well, then you'll find these processes unfolding. But the Buddha's great insight was that our sense of ourselves as a permanent, abiding, isolated self is merely relative. It's a construction, a very useful construction. It's an idea that we have that enables us to make the choices that make karma unfold a more and more satisfying, adequate and open consciousness for us. But they cannot provide us, it cannot provide us with ultimate satisfaction, because it's unreal. It's constructed. It's not the way things really are. So, yes, these processes that are implicit in reality, these dharma processes, implicit in reality, are unleashed when we begin decisively to break down our sense of ourselves as ultimate and separate. We feel those processes beginning to tug on us, well, even quite early on in our human lives. We feel them tugging at us. You know, I don't know whether others share this experience, like the middle of the night experience, when you just wake up in the middle of the night, not just because you've eaten too much or because something somebody said to you has troubled you, but for some reason one wakes in the stillness of the night when all influence is asleep around you. You feel yourself sort of in a tremendous peaceful vacuum. I'm speaking of this quite feelingfully, aren't I? Because I've had this experience a couple of times just over the last two or three nights. You wake up in that sort of mood, and sometimes, and I remember this quite early in my life, there's a sort of floating quality to it, a quality of something moving, something pulling, something calling, that seems to offer to carry you onward. Usually, in an untrained mind, there's a recoil. There's a recoil of fear, because it's inevitably connected with death, the sense of giving up, of ending, of death. So one recoils from this mood. But I believe it's a very common one. I believe most people at some time experience it, whether with fear and trembling, or with a kind of longing. Very common indeed. Maybe in moments of suspension, when you know, everything ends in your life. Maybe you've been sacked, or you've been jilted by the perfect lover, and you find yourself suddenly without a clear role or destiny. And before the mood of despair and anguish sets in, there's a moment of freedom, a moment of delight even, which you hardly dare admit to yourself, which promises something you know not what. You again, it's the sort of thing you experience when you hear a really effective, hearing a really effective work of art, or perceive, a witness, experience a really effective work of art. It seems to sort of call you beyond the ordinary. It seems to suggest something that's of a quite different order. So we feel those pullings, those promptings. I think they're quite common. They're natural. They're part of the nature of things, because the this sense of separate selfhood is illusory. It's ultimately illusory. It does, for practical purposes. It gets us to a class at 5:30. It keeps us sitting here even when we're bored or not feeling well or whatever. But it always frays at the edges. There, every now and again, it sort of its patchwork quality is betrayed, or the holes are betrayed, and some sort of strange light shines through. Often experienced as a strange darkness, because it seems a denial of everything that we live for. But in our best moments, a strange light that shines through. So it's there right from early on. But what we do in our Buddhist training is we train ourselves to accept this. We train ourselves in a way to court that experience of openness. Through karmic training, through gathering ourselves, through integrating ourselves, we form a real sense of ourselves as capable of shaping ourselves. And then through our positive actions, through our skillful actions, through practicing ethics, through practicing skillful activity, through right livelihood, through our practice in meditation, working on our minds, we shape for ourselves an experience, a consciousness that is more and more open, more and more flexible, more and more confident, more and more strong, more and more flexible, less and less bounded in by the insistence of a prejudice and narrow conviction, that is more and more able to take in bewilderment, the foundering of things, those moments when you really don't know what's going on and it's all right. Those moments when you sense that your sort of construction of things has failed to encompass everything, and you're left with a sort of wonderful and terrifying sense that you really don't know what's going on. And our karmic training enables us to be sort of, I won't say even necessarily happy, but to stay with that sense of foundering. It's Heidegger, isn't it? That sense of foundering. That sense of openness, emptiness, uncertainty, unclarity. Well, Keats, negative capability, being able to dwell amidst doubts, uncertainties and mysteries. Recognizing that ultimately this whole business of being alive is really beyond our comprehension. Our brains just cannot order it enough. Our intellectual comprehensions, even our emotional responses, just aren't big enough, aren't fast enough, aren't quick enough to take it all in. We'll never be the computer that can reproduce the universe. So we always sense, accept the sense that we've come to the limits, and we happily dwell in that sense of coming to the limits. This is what our karmic training enables us to do. So we can say that karmic training is mainly concerned with integration and the development of skillful intentions, positive emotion, positive relationship to the world around us, acting in ways that are constructive so that our consciousness emerges in increasingly flexible, fluid, open ways so that we can move on to a new phase in our spiritual unfoldment, which is this phase of receptivity, of openness, of mystery, of accepting mystery, of accepting that we don't know what to do, we don't know how to grasp it, of just being with that uncertainty, having that receptivity to open to whatever experiences are there. We begin to sense the sort of trembling of meanings beyond mere intellectual and emotional grasping or understanding or responding. We sense a deeper responsiveness. So this, you could say, that we've got we've got integration, we've got positive emotion. We need, through our karmic training, to develop spiritual receptivity. Spiritual openness. Openness not to anything in particular, just an ability to remain open with whatever experience brings in the deepest sense, listening for the still small voice, something that is beyond. I remember when I was first getting involved with Tri Ratna Buddhist community, our teacher, Gurgyan Sangharakshita, used to talk a lot about boredom. And, I experienced a lot of boredom as a young man. I think a lot of my sort of youthful endeavour was to get away from boredom. And he started talking about the positive value of boredom, which I found, first of all, shocking, and then extremely exciting. Get really bored. There are many opportunities for this, although the whole of our modern culture is increasingly good at delivering us from boredom, at providing at the flick of a thumb some distraction so that we don't experience this strange sort of sense of emptiness and uncertainty and even a sort of fear underneath the boredom. What shall I do? Underneath that, there's a fear. Because underneath it, there's a sense of, you know, what am I doing? Well, somebody said to me that they'd been to see Sangharakshita recently, and he'd said to them, he wanted to reverse the usual maxim, which is, don't just sit there, do something. And he said what he wanted to say was, don't just do something, sit there. So it's sort of spiritual receptivity is just sitting there with your boredom, whatever it's like, with your sense of uncertainty, even with your fear, your deep existential fear, your sense that you are worthless, you are without meaning, without purpose, that all the things that seem to have meaning are dust and taste of nothing. Just stay with that. If you stay with that, something begins to emerge. Maybe not particularly deep to begin with, but something begins to emerge. Spontaneous creative impulses begin to arise within you. Not necessarily impulses to do anything in particular, but impulses that are of a different and deeper kind. So this is where we begin to move on to the Dharma Niyama. But we need to do more work. We need to, in this mood of spiritual receptivity, we need to really allow ourselves to let go fully of the sense of ourselves as a separate identity, willed again and again into being. Well, we could say we need to die. We need to die spiritually, which means, in a sense, facing up to our real death, because death sort of puts the final full stop to all our volitional activity. It finally says to us that everything we've striven for, everything we've tried to achieve, at least in ordinary sense, is gone. Is in a certain sense worthless. You know, you struggle all your life. You work really hard. You get your gold watch if you're really lucky. I don't know what they give you nowadays. Your golden handshake. Well, actually, they just throw you onto the dole or whatever it is. Your minimal pension, shrinking pension, and you know, then it's the heart attack and the crematorium. Not to be too gentle about it, and you know, puts everything into perspective, really, doesn't it? So. You need to sort of face the reality of the situation and be willing to let go of this constructed self that wants to be something, wants to achieve something in a purely egoistic sense, in a sense of vanity, this sense of self that's based upon pride and ultimately based on insecurity, and just face up fully to the reality of the situation, to the what in Buddhism is defined as the true nature of the situation, which is that everything is impermanent, and that, my dears, means you. Actually, it also means me. Everything is impermanent. All the wonders are impermanent. All the horrors are impermanent too. This life is impermanent. Everything passes into the darkness, as it were, of death. There's no permanent entities. This is the second great insight of Buddhism. There's nothing that's fixed. There's nothing that stands outside change, that is the sort of subject of change or the object of change. We've got this illusion. We construct our experience as if, you know, there's somewhere at the back of me a kind of a permanent driver who's sitting in the driver's cab of my body, manoeuvring me through life, which is somehow separate from it all. I know this is a rather crude way of putting it, but when it comes down to it, that's really the way in which our experience is interpreted by us. And we have some sort of illusion that behind all the change, there's something out there that's really abiding, that really once we've got it, will give us complete satisfaction and happiness. That's all illusory, according to the Buddha's own insight. And actually, when you really just begin to reflect a little bit, you can see it's true, that this is the way things are. They're without anything that's fixed. There's no substantial, essential aspect of reality. Everything is in flux, everything is in change, everything rises and falls. And because of that, there's nothing that you can grab hold of and say, I've arrived. I've arrived at the final retirement home or whatever it is, where peace will be there, where I've got the sort of set of conditions, the set of circumstances which will make me completely safe. This is what one sort of does with life. I don't know whether you notice this in yourself. You sort of tend to think, when such and such happens, and the subtext is, I will be finally happy. When I've got that exam, when I've got my exams, then life will begin and it'll all be wonderful. When he or she finally sees that I am the most wonderful person in the world, that will be it. Then I'll have arrived. You know, those films that end with the couple going off into the golden sunset. It isn't like that, I can assure you. Well, I don't even need to assure you, you know. It has a sort of symbolic meaning, but in reality it ain't like that. Yes, you cannot create the mundane conditions, the worldly conditions that are completely safe. Well, you know, didn't we all think that that banks were safe? Didn't we all think that you know, the financial system was absolutely rock solid? I think I mentioned before that I went on a long solitary retreat, 8 months. I was off the air during the time that the financial crisis hit. And before I went, I put my few pennies in a bank on the internet, a very good bank, an Icelandic bank, as it happens, recommended to me by a money-saving expert, expert my foot. And when I came out of my retreat, I thought, I'll just check up, you know, how much my money has grown. You know, and the sign came up, sorry, money gone. Well, you know, I had been meditating, so I was able to sort of take it quite equanimously. Oh, get the bastards! Fortunately, the British government is utterly reliable and a totally fixed element, and I got my money back. They sent a gunboat to Iceland and got it back for me. Anyway, you know, you have this sort of feeling that governments and banks and the legal system are absolutely infallible. Well, they're not. We've just seen that. The whole world is shaken. Maybe it'll get a little bit of stability back again, probably. But, well, it seems to be having a lot of difficulty doing it. It's a bit like a drunken person trying to take a tray of drinks through a cocktail party. And every now and again they get steadied and... Anyway, I'll stop getting my metaphors. You know, we have this sort of sense that there's something permanent somewhere, and when we can get it all arranged, it'll be okay. So we need to see through that and stop grasping at it and accept that it's not like that, accept that it's not possible to fix any set of conditioned phenomenon, because all conditioned phenomena are subject to the laws of change, of decay, of arising and decay. So just let them go. You live amidst them. You know, they can give you some pleasure, they can cause some tears, but you're not sort of living for them or determined by them. This is what your spiritual practice takes you to. The deliberate undoing of the illusion of fixity. And we have meditations that in which we deliberately attack this illusion, so that we begin to let it go, and we begin to face the reality of things head on, fully, openly, with this mood of great openness, of willingness to accept the mystery, And the more we accept the impermanence things, the more we accept that we cannot fix things, the more we accept death, a spiritual death, the more something else opens up. The more we sense moving in us and through us processes that are not to do with I. Of course, they happen in you, if you see what I mean, but they're not based on I. So, well, one can talk of these in different ways. Buddhist tradition has explored these processes in many, many different ways. It explores them in terms, for instance, of more the process of moving away from this constructed selfhood. So, for instance, you see through it all, and you have a sense of distaste. You don't want it. You just don't want it. You don't want to be entangled with it. You sort of feel, well, no, I don't want that. It's not worth having. There's nothing there. So it's even sometimes spoken of as disgust. But it's not an emotional disgust. It's not a mere reactive disgust. It's just a sense that this has no meaning. This has no attraction. Even it is, in that sense, repulsive, because it means the dangers of immersion in a world that can only be cramping and confining. Then there's a sense of detachment. Detachment not as a sort of indifference, an anesthesis. It's not that you're so numb that you don't feel anything. It's just that you don't feel any interest, any desire. I went recently with a friend to IKEA. I might have said this last time I was here, because it's a wonderful illustration. IKEA is it's samsara writ large. It's very well done, because everything's packs down so neatly, and it's all really well designed and so forth, and the products are very good. Yes, it's Swedish. I was only there because I had to buy some bookshelves. That's all. I'm not really wanting to be there. And like that. Anyway, I went with a friend, and we were walking around. And it is quite strange if you sort of go there knowing what you want. And for a start, you know, they make sure you go through every single room and face every single product. And, you know, if you go there with a single-minded purpose, what you find, people floating around, reaching out, magnetically attracted to all the beautiful Swedish things that are there, all with really strange, unpronounceable names. And you're deeply sort of drawn by them. Anyway, we were purposefully going through IKEA. My friend was walking through with an increasingly broad grin on his face, smile on his face. So I thought, oh, he's obviously seen some design that he really likes. But after a while he said, I feel really happy in here. So I said, oh, well, that's interesting. Why? He said, because there's nothing here I want. And that's what this mood is that arises on a far deeper level than that. It's not just about IKEA. It's about the whole supermarket of life, about the whole furniture store of reality. There's nothing there that you want. And you're not even disgusted by it. Because disgust is more where you feel a slight pull and then a no. But you just, yeah, interesting. Yeah. There it is. Maybe even able to appreciate a good design as just a good design and pass on. So that's what comes next. And then that just deepens in, and really we begin to get beyond what words can say, to a feeling of complete freedom. A feeling that you're not bounded by anything at all. Nothing can hold you, nothing can contain you. You're not drawn to anything, you're not suspended from anything, you're just completely free. If that's not enough, that leads to a deep sense of recognition that this freedom is based on something completely unshakable. You realize there's nothing in you that can draw you back. There's no impulses within you that can take you back into the state of clinging and the state of construction, the state of limitation. You're completely free. So beyond that, really, words fail. What happens after that, the tradition remains mute. Buddhist tradition is quite reticent about talking about the content of these experiences beyond this point, because it doesn't want us to start to grab them with our conceptual minds and think thereby that we've understood them and that maybe we've had them when we haven't. So it leaves it entirely to mystery. And there's a sort of sign at this point, here be mysteries. Let go of all your understanding. The magic circus in Steppenwolf, Hermann Hesse's novel. You just leave your mind behind, leave your understanding behind. So it's talked of in those ways, more in terms of what you're moving away from. It's also often talked of in terms of the very, very strong positive experiences unfolding. But in a way, the metaphors, you know, the superlatives piled on superlative just doesn't really necessarily communicate anything. Like the blazing, the far going. They don't really communicate very much unless you've sort of got some a hint of what these experiences are, but increasing sense of creative wonder, that artistic creativity is perhaps often a prefiguration of creativity on increasingly unimaginable planes, even experience within this life, a sense of inner wonder and inner glory. A riches unfolding within you. Sometimes it's spoken of more in terms of in encounter with increasingly glorious figures and images, which are in tradition taken quite literally or expressed quite literally, but also in a mysterious way. They're neither to be taken literally nor dismissed as symbolic. They exist in a realm of neither the literal nor the symbolic, which is very hard to express, where the ontology becomes beyond our ordinary philosophy, so that you experience your experience is mediated through these figures of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas appearing to you from beyond you. But increasingly merging with you, images that are made of light, that are radiant with an inner glow that is not reflected from an outer medium, like images in this world are reflected light of the sun or other light source. They are self-luminous, and where the light is increasingly subtle, and the colours are beyond what we can describe, what our ordinary palette can paint, and where when you try to portray them, you sense that you cannot do them justice. But these express the quality of the experience that's unfolding within you, and which becomes increasingly refined, and where the sense of separation between you and what you're experiencing becomes more and more thin and ultimately dissolves altogether. And all can happen while you're a living, breathing human being. This is what happened to the Buddha 2,500 years ago. He entered these realms where the world of construction, the world of egoistic construction, just dissolved for him, held no more attractions for him. He was completely beyond it. Where a succession of mental states unfolded within him of an unimaginable richness and creativity, and where he experienced himself within a realm of light and colour with beings, radiant beings that were beyond anything he'd ever experienced before. So we can approach it through all these different, even you could say metaphorical frameworks. What the experience ultimately is, what you have to experience. We can only find approximations within our ordinary experience to interpret them or communicate them. But always those experiences are greater than that. I remember our teacher talking about the great Victorian art critic. I think I might have said this again on another ramble. It's something that I found very helpful. Ruskin, John Ruskin, said that people go to the British Museum and they see the Apollo Belvedere, the depiction of Apollo that was found in Rome but was based on a Greek model. And when they see that Apollo Belvedere, they think they know what Apollo looks like. But that's only a sort of mundane approximation in marble to what this godlike figure is really like, what the quality that Apollo embodies is really like. Well, Apollo is a god taken from the Greco-Roman tradition. What we're talking about is something on another level altogether. That our philosophical language can only hint at, that our psychological explanations can only provide us with an analogy, that our images can only suggest, but that ultimately we have to experience within us, and we experience it when we go through these processes. So we need to go through the process of taking proper control, as it were, of our karmic identity, taking possession of ourselves as responsible beings, ethically responsible beings. If we don't do that, and we try to die spiritually, we'll open ourselves up to who knows what. There are all sorts of processes within reality. And we may open ourselves up to evil. We may open ourselves up to a mere sidetracks. So we need, first of all, to build ourselves a full karmic responsibility. We need to integrate ourselves. And we need to make our emotions positive, our volitions positive, so that we're increasingly capable of opening up to the mystery of things. And we need, on that basis of karmic development, on the basis of integration and positive emotion, we can begin to develop spiritual receptivity. We can develop a sensitivity to the call of something more, the call of something beyond, which we'll find echoing even in these moments in the middle of the night. We'll find calling in art. We'll find calling in something of what we read. Sometimes we'll find it calling in unexpected situations, in completely unexpected situations, just pulling us, tugging at us. You read William James' Varieties of Religious Experience, which is a wonderful book. You're just collecting up the beginnings of a true phenomenology of religion. And one of the ones that really attracted me was of a Yorkshire policeman who lived the other side of the Dales from where his beat was. And he reported and was recorded by James as saying every evening when he walked home from his beat duty, walking across the moors, he was transfigured. And what he describes is a state of extraordinary, mystic elevation. He's obviously a quite ordinary man, not particularly educated, presumably a quite good man. But this just overcame him. He didn't seek it. It just happened to us, to him. So these sort of experiences happen to us, but we need to become receptive to them. Often we think they're scary, or maybe we even think we're going mad. Or we think we haven't got time for it, or we think it's going to stop us from doing what we need to do. But we need to develop a receptivity to those moods, the pull of something further, of something higher. So that's our third factor, spiritual receptivity. We then need to develop spiritual death, this willingness to really see through the illusion of separateness, the illusion of fixity, the illusion of completeness within this life, and just die, be willing to die, not be afraid of it. Even if we are afraid of it, face it. And we need to be reborn. We need to allow these processes to unfold within us, that unfold quite naturally when the conditions are there. Just as when a light body encounters a heavy body, it's attracted to it under the law of gravity. When you set up the conditions of integration, of positive emotion, of receptivity, of spiritual death, spiritual rebirth begins to take place. You find those processes unfolding quite naturally. You find yourself with volitions arising in you that have nothing to do with I, a non-egoistic volition. Dying to self doesn't mean becoming a blank. It means that there unfolds within you a succession of mental states that are selfless, so that what unfolds within you is a stream of compassionate activity, spontaneous compassionate activity. Not compassion as an emotion, compassion as an immediate spontaneous response. When the situation requires it, you respond. And you respond with what is appropriate, with what is needed. You don't need to think, you don't need to cogitate, you don't need to emote. You just respond. Need, response. And you become increasingly a force of that kind. And of course that brings enormous joy, enormous pleasure, enormous happiness, at the same time as a deep responsiveness to the suffering around. But strangely, that sense, that responsiveness to suffering, a compassionate response to suffering, is not destructive of joy. The two emerge, go completely hand in hand. And you just, as from a certain point, you can just let go, stop making any effort, stop bothering. It's what in Buddhism is called entering the stream of the Dhamma. And at the point of entering the stream of the Dhamma, no more effort is required. Nothing. You don't need to struggle. You don't need to think. You don't need to interrogate yourself. You don't need to exercise your conscience. You just completely spontaneously respond to what needs to be done. You can accelerate the process by some reflection, some effort, but even if you don't do it, it's just like floating on the stream. But we need to create the basis. Through karma, we create the basis. So you could say it's a bit like trying to go down a river, a very, very fast flowing, very wide river. The current flows down the middle, of the river. I just read a very beautiful passage in a book by a Hungarian author, Faludje Gyorgy, if I pronounce that rightly. And he's describing floating in the Danube, floating in the midst of the Danube, and just going with the current, and completely giving himself up to the current. But of course, before you can do that, you need to get into the current. If you're standing on the bank, you won't float anywhere. If you even get into the shallows, well, you might just get caught up in those eddies that often go with the side of a river. or you might just find yourself stuck in the mud. I've been there. Or getting caught up with a rock or something like that. So you need to actively get yourself into the middle. You need to actively get yourself into the stream. This is karma. This is the effort of karma. Karma is the deliberate swimming out, sometimes with great hardship, sometimes with great difficulty. The water's cold. The current is strong. You're weak. You don't feel like it because there's somebody calling on the shore, or you're leaving behind a something that's very attractive. You know, IKEA is waiting. You have to make a real effort to build yourself up, build your muscles, build your stamina, so that you can swim out into the current. That's karma. It's the effort of integrating yourself so that you become fully possessed of your own ethical responsibility. You need to make your volitions entirely skillful, entirely positive, so that you have a body that is capable of getting out into the middle of the stream. Once you're in the middle of the stream, once you accept, you open up to the stream, you stop struggling against it. That's your receptivity. And you let go of your attachment to being on the shore. That's your death. And you just let the current take you. That's your rebirth. And it will take you to the wider and wider seas, more and more beautiful, warmer, more and more rich, creative, delightful, and more beneficial. The analogy breaks down here. But as you go with that stream, you're more and more capable of benefiting others because you've resolved the deepest questions of life. And you can bring to people what they really need because you embody it. You stand in it. So you stand beyond the struggles and strains that get people into so much trouble. Then they're struggling to be free. They dig themselves deeper and deeper into the mud. So this is how we work with karma and dharma. We work with karma and dharma by integrating ourselves. We work with karma by integrating ourselves, by developing positive emotion, skillful intention. We work with karma by developing spiritual receptivity. Spiritual receptivity is in a way on the dividing line between the two. You develop an awareness of those currents as they flow within you, and you allow yourself to open up to them. And you develop the process of dharma by dying, by allowing yourself to die to the notion of yourself as separate, as fixed and separate, and of allowing yourself to be reborn to these dharma processes. And I again return to the point I made at the beginning. These forces are implicit in reality. They're not given by anybody. They're not guaranteed by anybody. There's nothing outside reality that sort of holds reality together or judges things and weighs things. These are laws built into the structure of things, just as gravity, photosynthesis, etc. are built into the structure of things. And it's very important for us, if we really want to find our highest human satisfaction and fulfillment, that we come to be convinced by and rely upon these processes, these laws, just as we rely upon the processes of gravity to move around the place. We need to rely on the processes of karma and the processes of dharma and have the same sort of faith in them, a faith that's based on experience to some extent, is based on our confidence in great beings, but that ultimately must be a conviction that we have, and that we can allow ourselves to live our lives on the basis of. So I hope that I've at least made the structure of our spiritual lives a little bit clear to you, and what it is that we need to confide ourselves to. We need to confide ourselves to processes that are quite objective. They're not made up. They are inside us, but they're not made up by us. They're not human constructions. They're things, they're forces that we can discover, and that as we place our faith in them, will bring us more and more happiness and fulfillment. Now, I should really give you time for questions, but in a way, maybe better just to leave it there, and especially as I'm saved by the bell. Yes, I hope that we can explore these things more and more on another occasion. Thank you very much.